Is there anything better than a frosty brew? Is there anything more satisfying after a long day of exploration in a foreign country than sitting down to a tall glass of delicious local beer? And the great thing about it is that for travellers, beer is not just a drink, it's a culture. It's a window into local life, an icebreaker, a friend maker. To drink a beer while you're overseas is to very often immerse yourself in local life, to soak up centuries of tradition in quite often beautiful places, while also just having a really good time. So cheers to the beer, all hail to the ale, because today we're here to talk about the humble brew. Everything that's good, everything that's cultural, everything that's fun. Hi, I'm Ben Groundwater, and you're listening to Flight of Fancy, the traveller.com.au podcast. We're getting a little boozy today, as you may have guessed. We're travelling through the world's great beer cultures, looking at the cherished traditions and the modern customs. Joining me to do this today, I have two of the best qualified beer-loving travellers you could hope to meet. First up, she's a frequent guest on Flight of Fancy, whose German heritage has surely instilled in her a deep love of a frosty brew, Uta Jonker.
Hi, Ben.
Hi, Uta. Also with us today, he's a filmmaker and producer who goes by the alter ego of the beer pilgrim, Tim Schirodi.
I'm trying to open... Hello, Ben. How you
Hi,
going,
Tim.
Mate?
How you doing? Thanks for joining us, guys.
Oh, mate, thanks for having me.
Now, I always...
Bloody awesome.
Before people come on this podcast, I always say that what we're aiming for is like a pub-style chat. But this is definitely the closest we've ever come to that because we have actual beer in the studio.
I've literally just opened a beer.
You did. How many beers have you brought today, Tim?
I brought 5 beers for us today. So a nice big array of beers from all around the world with
Amazing.
A fascinating story about each one.
I feel like this is going to be a fun little episode.
Yeah, I'd say order a taxi. So.
Tell us about the Beer Pilgrim. What's the story there?
So, as you know, I'm obsessed with travel. I've been traveling all my adult life. And as I was traveling around the world, I noticed that almost every country and culture that I experienced, there was one thing that remained constant. Almost everywhere you can find beer. And in many places around the world, they've got a really long history of beer, especially in Europe.
Yep.
And I find that the history of beer and these different beer styles are quite heavily entwined with the history and the culture of each place. So I really became interested in beer itself and also how you can experience different cultures and different places through beer. And it itself is a fascinating beverage. It's 9,000 years old, more
right.
or less, and just... Everything about it just blows me away.
Uta, has your German heritage instilled in you a love of beer?
Natürlich. Actually, I have to say, growing up, I wasn't that much of a beer drinker. But when I was living and working in Germany, it's really difficult. It's not difficult to order anything other than beer. They have it there. But it's like if everyone else has their 1 litre mass of beer
right.
and you're not, you know, you're there holding your little champagne flute and you're knocking over 4 of those every time they finish a beer. So in the end, I just drank the beer.
Right. I mean, a litre of beer is a serious assignment, isn't it?
There is no way in Sydney I would ever drink a litre of beer. But when I was living in Munich, knock off 2 or 3 a night, no problem.
I don't even order a pint in Sydney. And you know, you go to the UK and you would feel ridiculous for not ordering a pint.
Yeah.
And that's just the normal size of a beer. But over here, that seems like too much beer in a way.
And it's interesting that, as Tim is saying, it's a cultural thing. It's a rhythm of a night out. You know, that's what I found. If I was drinking wine or champagne or something, I wasn't drinking to the same rhythm as everyone else, which makes you feel a little bit awkward.
Yeah.
You know, and the same thing in England. You got to have the pint.
Yeah. You do.
That keeps you in sync with everyone.
I was at a pub in Scotland and they were doing a sort of special promotion where you got when you bought a pint, you also got a half pint free of this certain beer. And so everyone was getting their pint and their half pint, taking it back to their table, drinking the pint and then pouring the half pint into the pint glass so that no one would be seen to be drinking a half pint of beer. No one orders a half pint.
No.
Have you guys been to any countries where you've been surprised to find that there is a beer culture? Obviously, you know, things like places like Germany and Belgium, you know, it's so well known.
North Korea.
North Korea.
Excellent beer.
Wow. Yeah.
And it turns out, and of course...
Because South Korean beer is pretty bad, I've got to say.
Absolutely. But you know what the North Koreans had? They were part of they were part of the communist bloc in a loose affiliated sense.
Yeah.
They had access to the East Germans. They sent for the East Germans and said, teach
pretty
us how to make beer.
Pretty much anywhere with German heritage has good beer. Namibia is one of them as well.
Yes.
They have the best beer in Africa, hands down. Windhoek. It's a great beer.
So, yeah, just follow the Germans and you'll find good beer.
Also, Beer Lao in Laos. was set up by some Germans a fairly long time ago, which explains why it's by far Southeast Asia's best beer.
Oh, agreed.
Yeah.
100%.
What about you, Tim? Have you been anywhere and been surprised to find that the beer is
everywhere.
Good?
But I find a lot of places you go, they've got their own kind of little cultural twist on beer or a different version of beer that we might not even consider beer, but they do. Like in Africa, you've got sorghum beer.
Right.
They've got... Oh, now I'm going to try and pronounce this, the Umwoti in South Africa.
I'm going to assume that was perfect.
Which is their local traditional sorghum beer that they drink. So they all sit around the big gourd and then they drink it. And I spent a few nights doing that, which is took me a good month to learn how to say the word.
Yeah.
But that's the cluster.
You still haven't learned to say it. Pull me another one. Let's try that again.
And then in Peru, they've got chicha.
Corn beer, isn't it?
Corn beer, In
Vietnam, beer hoi.
Yeah.
Which is fresh beer, which is basically homebrew that these bars have that they sell for, I think it's like about 20 or 30 cents a glass. And they're really sort of knockabout places. You go and get some cheap food, you get some nice beer, and everyone just kind of sits around and on plastic stools in these dodgy little places. And it's fantastic.
Rwanda, they have banana beer that I had in Rwanda. Yeah. Like almost everywhere you go, they've got some kind of version of it.
They do, yeah.
In Iceland, they have whale testicle beer.
Wow. Oh, what?
Yes.
I mean, this has always been a podcast of story one-upmanship. I think that might just take the cake.
Made using sheep dung to smoke it.
Really?
So whale testicles.
Where do the whale testicles come into the...
Well, you buy them from the whale meat person. Right. He has the testicles.
How are they involved in the beer creation process?
You get the sheep dung, you smoke the whale testicle. I have a very strange job.
Yeah.
My mother didn't send me to university so I could sit here talking about smoking whale testicles.
Have you drunk it?
I had some flat because it was out of season when I was
there.
There is a season for it.
For whale.
Because there's a season in which you harvest the whales. Okay. And that's when you get the whale testicles and that's when you make the beer.
Right.
So the stuff that I had, he went, look, he went, no, I've got some for myself, but it's passed. I said, yeah, come on, hit me up. Go on. And it pretty much was redolent of dung with a hint of fish in it. It's not the best beer I had in Iceland.
Okay, sure. Yeah. How big is a whale testicle?
I have no idea. We didn't do show and tell.
All right, now, Tim, the Beer Pilgrim, you're going to take us through some beers and we're going to kind of chat about the history and the culture around them and basically use it as an excuse to drink beer.
Yep, sounds good to me, mate.
Yeah.
Okay, so first beer off the bat, we've got the Weihenstephaner Festbier. Now, this is a beer that was brewed specifically for Oktoberfest this past year. And every year, most breweries in Bavaria will make a beer specifically for Oktoberfest, which is generally a little bit higher in alcohol.
Right. Yeah, I'd heard that because people at Oktoberfest have such a struggle getting drunk.
Yeah, I know. They really struggle, don't they? They seem to do a good job last time I was there.
Right.
So this one's Weihenstephaner. Now, this beer, this brewery itself is the oldest brewery on planet Earth. It's close to 1,000 years old, which is just mind-boggling. And it's just outside of Freising in Munich.
And you can get this in Australia, can you?
Yeah. I mean, I've got this in a very specific kind of beer retailer called... Beer Cartel. Oh, they love me. I spent a lot of money in that place. Beer Cartel and Artarmon have it. But it's got to be fresh. The things with beer, unlike wine and whiskey and whatever, is beer's best when it's fresh. So while I'm getting all these beers from overseas, I'm making sure they're from sources where they're relatively fresh. If they go out of date, they really lose a lot of flavor and character. So this one is quite fresh. But I suppose I'll take you through the how to drink beer thing.
All right.
So first thing when you're drinking beer as a bit of a beer connoisseur is to look at it, have a nice look into the beer, look through it. So this one's nice and clear, it's gold and it's got a nice white fluffy head. And that already tells you quite a lot about the beer, the malts, how they were toasted. Next step is to take a nice big sniff of the beer. If you get a little dot of froth on your nose, you're doing it correctly. So get your snout right on in there, guys. Yep.
My nose isn't big enough to. Does that mean I'm not a good beer drinker?
This is with aroma, something like 75 to 95% of everything we taste comes from aroma, which is why it's so important to smell the beer. So it takes a smell. And that's also why you always pour a beer. If you drink it out of a bottle, it's kind of like, having a nice meal with a peg on your nose, I guess.
Right.
And then my favorite part is to drink. So okay. Unlike wine, you have to drink it all the way down.
Prost.
Prost. Nicely Prost. Done.
There we Always. Go.
So anyway, so what do you guys think? You mean
delicious?
Enjoy that one?
Yeah, excellent. So what style of beer is it? It's not a lager? What is it?
It's a kind of Heller's lager.
Okay.
So a lot of the beers, the Bavarian traditional beers, are lagers.
Yep.
Because, you know, the German word lager is to store. So the story behind the lager is actually quite fascinating in its own. It was, they used to store their beer in caves over, they brew it in the winter months and they store it in caves, mm-hmm. basically packed with ice all around it in big barrels. And then one day, by some stroke of luck, yeast came in there. The lager yeast just basically naturally formed in these tunnels and it started brewing differently. Because it was basically gave birth in these tunnels, it's called a lager beer.
Right.
Now it's the most popular beer on planet Earth. Every kind of mainstream beer that you would drink is a lager. Everything yep. from Heineken, VB. But this is a good lager, yep. in my mind.
Very good lager. Uta, have you been to Oktoberfest?
I have.
Yeah.
I went with my work colleagues. Because when you work in Munich...
right, I've heard
you
about
go,
this. Yeah.
On, it's a work outing. There's two work outings you do. You do the Oktoberfest, where you go and you drink big 1 litre masses of...
So a mass is the name for the huge
is
glass.
Is the name for the huge glass that holds yeah. a litre of beer. And, you know, you see the women who work there have 8 of them per hand. And you
right.
just kind of go, you ladies are scary. And then the other one you do is Fasching, which is Carnival,
mm-hmm.
which is when you go and drink beer with your colleagues in the snow at 10 a.m. So it's, and it's, you know, obviously you're with your colleagues. It's not about getting drunk. It's about having a proper social occasion. You just happen to be knocking back litres of beer at the same time.
Right. Because there's Oktoberfest and there's Oktoberfest, isn't there? Because I've been to the Hofbräuhaus,
mm-hmm.
Which is basically, there's how many tents are there of different breweries? About 16 or so, I think.
I don't know.
Plenty. There's a whole lot of huge tents, beer tents at Oktoberfest, and each brewery in Bavaria has its own beer tent.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them in particular is known as a place that a lot of the foreign tourists go to, Australians and Italians, and they just get absolutely slaughtered.
Yeah.
And to a lot of Australians, that's what Oktoberfest is. It's getting extremely drunk extremely quickly. But for Germans, that's not necessarily what it's about.
No, that's totally not what it's about. It's
yeah.
just about a seasonal thing where instead of, you know, say going to the pub or going to a bar or going to a restaurant, you just go to Oktoberfest instead.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's all...
it's all handled very maturely.
It's all very polite, you
yeah.
know?
Okay. What's been your experience?
Look of horror on his face.
I was just at Oktoberfest, and I don't right. know if it's entirely seen like that by the Germans. Maybe a large portion of them.
I'm guessing depends on what time you go.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I was there on the very last day.
And what time of day?
I started at midday, and then I think we finished at like 4 a.m. or something.
Yeah, 4 a.m. is probably a different scenario.
But from about 3 p.m, it's the same.
Really?
It was absolute mayhem.
I don't know what tents you were hanging out in, my friend.
I went from I went from one to the other, but it was mayhem. Mm.
Yeah.
Did you say you were on the last day?
Very last
yeah.
day.
But yeah, I was talking to some people who live in Munich, and they were saying all of the companies book a table for their employees to go to as mm-hmm. as just, and you know, you take a day off and you go and hang out there, and that's the thing you do.
Yeah. I've only been once, and that was for one day. So maybe I just got it on the most rambunctious day.
And there are a whole bunch of other Oktoberfests, aren't there, in Bavaria? It's not just
yeah.
the main one in Munich that everybody knows about. There's also little country festivals.
I went to one called Bergkirchweih, which mm-hmm. is out in Erlangen. And when I was going there, I was actually in Munich on my way there, and I was speaking to the locals, and these were like beery folk, people that know a little bit about beer.
Yeah.
And I was saying I'm going to this festival, and most of them were like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And it was just considered to this small, cozy little regional beer festival. Mm-hmm. Literally quoted, small, cozy regional beer festival, which I found out attracts over 1 million people every year.
Right.
Runs over 12 days, and it's been running for 250 years. And it is just the most incredible beer festival I think I've ever been
yeah,
to.
Right.
It's all revolved around these lagering tunnels. So it's been going on for centuries and centuries. Basically, at the end of winter, they bring all the barrels out for people to drink, and they have done for centuries. And people go around and have this big festival in there. You feel like Asterix and Obelix. You know, you've got these entire pigs and cows.
I guess fewer foreign tourists at something like that. It's more of a local experience.
Almost, like, I didn't actually meet any.
Yeah.
Everyone that I met was local.
Yeah.
And local to, like, Bavarian, Franconian, like, really quiet, local. Not many people travel from far and wide to go there, but
yeah.
it still attracted over 1 million people. So that
wow.
just kind of goes to show how heavily ingrained beer is in the local culture down
yeah.
there.
And I found in Bavaria, even if you don't turn up during Oktoberfest time when the celebrations are on, it's still a great place to go and drink beer because people are so passionate about it there. And
in Munich?
Yeah, in Munich.
And
yeah.
They've got lovely beer gardens and they've got beautiful, the great big beautiful beer halls.
Yeah.
And,
there's a place called Andex, which is a monastery out in the countryside near Munich. And people take the train out there and then they trek up a hill to get to
the
spot. And then
you eat the smoked trout on the stick.
Yeah, yeah. It's beautiful. Yeah, it's just such a really friendly sort of convivial environment that involves.
A lot of beer.
This podcast is brought to you by Intrepid Travel. To be intrepid, you need to be open. And what's more open than sharing a beer with new friends in a faraway country? With Intrepid, you'll be able to experience a destination the way the locals do. From Oktoberfest in Germany to a pint of Guinness in Dublin and even a fresh beer hoy in the bars of Hanoi, our local guides will get you to the heart of local culture and local beers in no time. Find out more at intrepidtravel.com.
Are there other places in Germany that are that into beer? Or
Bavaria is the famous one, but everywhere in Germany has a serious beer culture. So you can go up the north coast and there's some beautiful little towns and, you know, these are places that in the year 1400 had, you know, 33 breweries.
Right.
And you go, what the hell? And okay, they've only got three left, but those three are really good.
Yeah, right. They've been there a while, yeah.
So it's you can really sort of chart your way along.
Yep.
It's, I mean, although probably the city in Germany that is considered to be the most, the capital city of beer is Bamberg, which is in Bavaria.
Bamberg's incredible.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, it's a beautiful city and it's got, how many, they've got something like 16 breweries inside the city limits, plus another 30 odd just outside.
Wow.
And the specialty is Rauchbier, which is smoke beer. So you smoke the malt, right? Before you make it. And it's this dark, chewy beer. It's really good.
It's a Mautzen. It's like a Mautzen style beer, so it's really kind of sticky and chewy, as you say, and it's super smoky.
Yeah.
Because they smoke, and it's got to be smoked with a certain birch wood that grows in the outskirts around Bamberg. And, the main brewery that makes this one is Schlenkela, and I think they date back to the year 1340 or something ridiculous.
And they're in the same building, and the whole building looks a little bit crooked, but it seems to be standing, so okay, fine.
But Cologne as well is a great place for beer.
Absolutely.
They drink a beer called the Kölsch there.
Yep.
In fact, I've got a beer here that's made by an Australian brewery, Four Pines, and they made a Kölsch. But technically it's illegal because the people in Cologne love their Kölsch so much that they actually protected it same way champagne's being protected in France.
Yeah, yeah.
So it can only be called a Kölsch if it's made in Cologne.
Yep.
So this brewery in Sydney, Four Pines, made their version of the Kölsch. And how they got away with it, they just took the umlaut out from the O, took the two dots away from the O.
I mean, that's got to make no difference to Australians whatsoever.
Now it's a good old Aussie Kölsch.
Yeah, it's not good.
And it's bloody beautiful.
Yeah. All right, well, what's up next?
Well,
the Beer Pilgrim.
Here's a very interesting German style beer. It's actually brewed here in Sydney, but it's a Gösser.
Right.
And the Gose is a style of beer that comes from originally from the Harz Mountain region of Germany, but now the spiritual home of this style is in Leipzig.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bizarre beer. It's slightly salty,
and
it's also slightly sour as well. So it's a sour, salty beer, and the reason is because the river that it used to be traditionally brewed on in the Harz River was quite full of salt. So it's a salty beer, but now it's been picked up by the craft beer community, and now it's being sold all around the world, and craft brewers are making it absolutely everywhere. This one here is brewed by Nomad Brewing up on the northern beaches of Sydney, and... doesn't that sound beautiful? And this one's actually including a little bit of watermelon in it as well.
Whoa.
So,
watermelon.
Watermelon goes.
That's not a traditional German beer ingredient.
No, it's
I just
not.
Need you to know.
Yeah. And so that's the other thing with German beers is they still brew according to a 500-year-old law called the Reinheitsgebot, which is a beer purity law of 1516. So beer can only consist of three ingredients, which was water, malt and hops. So okay. Then when they discovered yeast later on, when Louis Pasteur did his thing, it was now water, malt, hops and yeast.
Right, okay.
And it can't be made by any other ingredients. So this is why the German breweries are so, they have their hands tied by tradition, and which is why the craft beer thing is taking a long time to take hold in Germany.
Yeah.
They've got fantastic beer anyway, so they don't really need it. But the ones that are trying to sort of diversify are finding it a bit hard for tax reasons because they still have this law.
So it smells really fruity.
Yeah, so that would be the watermelon. So as I said, this brewery doesn't abide by the Reinheitsgebot whatsoever.
Wow, that does not even smell like a beer.
Yeah, so this is a Gosa.
So this has got a giant squid on the label. It's not something that looks particularly traditional at all.
No, so this is a craft beer from Brookvale up on the northern beaches in Sydney. And these guys basically brew whatever they want. So they really they really push the boundaries.
That is actually surprisingly tasty.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of fruit, but the salt kind of balances out that sweetness.
It's kind of the margarita of beers.
It is. It's extremely drinkable. This is dangerous.
So this brewery, they're quite like famous how they make the Gosa. They make a whole variety of different styles of Gosa beer based on that traditional German style, but they'll add in watermelon, they'll add in Tasmanian pepper berries, like whatever they can. But one of the main ingredients they use for these beers is seawater. They'll go down to Freshwater Beach and fill up kegs filled with seawater and add that to the beer, and that adds a salinity
This is the most northern beaches thing I've ever heard. They're
so
actually using the actual water. When you told me about this beer, it made me think of the Belgian style of beer, because they're obviously maybe a little bit more experimental in their beer culture. You get like raspberry beers and very sour beers, which I absolutely hate with a raging passion.
The lambic beers, which use wild yeast instead of actually the normal domestic yeast. So they are an acquired taste, aren't they?
It's an acquired taste. Yeah. But so talk me through Belgian beer culture as well while we're here. Yep. How does it differ from German beer culture?
I find it's maybe not as heavily ingrained in the general culture as it is in Germany. Germany, it's just filled into every single aspect of German culture.
Right.
In Belgium, it's more like a certain portion of society are really into their beers, but they have a really long, very rich beer history.
Yeah, this is Trappist monks used to make beer, or still do make beer.
Still
don't
do,
they?
Yeah. So you can go to some monasteries in the countryside in Belgium and drink beer that was made by monks in the monastery, and they still do. So that's quite a special thing to do. Mm. But my favorite part about Belgian beer is the sour beers, the lambic beers that you can try.
Yeah.
Just for this idea of this, the way they ferment, it's technically the most old-fashioned, ancient form of beer that you could possibly get, because it's brewed using wild yeast that basically lands on the wort and it just spontaneously ferments like that. So you get this really kind of complex, funky, sour, I think quite delicious beer style, which is the one that you hate.
I guess it was just an expectation thing, because I was picturing like a hoppy pale ale or something like that.
Yeah, and the thing is, if you'd known the story behind it, you probably would have tasted it very differently. And that's the thing I love about Belgian beers is there's an immense amount of creativity. When I was in Ghent, I met this woman who was working to get her Master's of Brewer certificate, and she had this idea. Hops came into beer in the 13th century as a preservative. It means you can ship the beer somewhere else and it'll last. And before they had... So in Belgium, before they had hops, they used something called groot. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, no one quite knows what groot is. You know, it's one of those things that's been lost, because hops took over and no one wanted groot.
Yeah.
And she had this theory that she wanted to try and make beer using groot, try and find out what groot is. Mm-hmm. And so she proposed it to her master supervisor, and he went, it's never going to work, but go for it, try it, it'll be interesting.
Yep.
And she worked on it for a year, and she tried every avenue she could. And after a year, she went back to her supervisor, showing him what she'd done, and she went, you're right, it's not going to work. You know, we'll find something else. And he looked through it and went, you know, I think you're onto something.
Oh, yeah.
Give it another year. And after another year, she apparently discovered how to do it. So she now has a brewery that makes entirely hopless beers.
Wow.
So they don't have the bitterness, which is what you get from the hops.
Yeah.
So, and it's in the middle of Ghent, and you can go in there and chat to her and drink her beers. And it's really, really cool.
Yeah. So, Tim, what's the beer culture like in Belgium? Like, is it, you know, everyone going out and getting hammered, or is it a more of a sort of genteel type thing?
They don't have the drinking culture that you'll find, say, in Australia, where it's quite excessive. They really do appreciate their beers.
Yeah.
And they've got a lot of respect for beers and brewers.
Is it like the beer garden style of Germany, or is it different to that as well?
Yes, you get that. Absolutely. Mm. I mean, if you go to the monasteries and drink beer in the Trappist monasteries, you'll find yourself in a cafe.
Right.
It's all about the cafes there. So you'll have like a cafe and a little outside area and you'll be drinking beers around the table. Very similar to the German beer garden.
Right, okay.
Not on that scale.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a lot more quaint and a lot more cozy.
Yeah.
Having said that, you can go into Brussels and go to Delirium Beer Cafe where they've got 2,000 beers on their menu.
They've got
a World Guinness Book of Records record for it. But I don't know if they have that level of moderation in the way people drink there, but that's mostly a travel crowd, really, at that place.
Right. Yeah.
But generally across the board, it's a lot more, I suppose, moderate in the way they drink. They drink for quality, not quantity.
So what are we going on to next?
I think, we've got to talk about the craft beer world, because craft beer has really sort of taken hold around the planet.
I think that's a really exciting thing about the world beer scene. It's not just these really traditional old places that are doing beer. It's kind of the new world as well.
Absolutely. And I mean, the United States is really leading the charge in that.
Yep.
So I think for like traditional beer culture and how ingrained beer is with culture and all that kind of, you look to the old world, but if you want to look at innovation in beer and the exciting changes and the craft beer world, which is just going completely gangbusters, you need to look at places, the new world. So like the United States, Australia is also very good, and New Zealand. So what we have here is from a very popular West Coast US brewery called Sierra Nevada. It's called Hop Hunter IPA.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the IPA's got a pretty interesting story. It came about, it's called the India Pale Ale.
Yep.
It came about because the English had a lot of troops and a lot of settlers in the sort of mid-18th to early 19th century in India, and they all had a hankering for good old English beer in that tropical heat.
Yep.
So to make the journey from England all the way around to India in the heat and temperature changes, and it could be months and months at sea, they had to preserve the beer. So they increased the alcohol and they increased the hops, two natural preservatives in beer.
Yep.
And so what arrived in India was a high alcohol, fully flavored beer.
Yep.
Now known as the IPA, the India Pale Ale.
Right.
And the,
so that's in the same way as wine was fortified to get across to the UK from Porto.
It's amazing how many changes there are in drinks and in beers, like how they kind of morphed and changed based on sea travel.
Yeah.
It's a big thing. There's another beer that I'll show you guys later on that has a very similar story. So this is the IPA. Mm-hmm. It's from Sierra Nevada.
Yep. Where is Sierra Nevada based? In California?
It's in California.
Or? Right.
Yeah. And when we're talking about craft beer and IPAs and really hoppy beers in particular, we're looking at West Coast USA. That's kind of ground zero. That's where it really is all the big changes. And it's
That's where everyone's wearing like plaid shirts and beards. And
exactly. Plenty of hipsters around toting their craft beer merch. So this one's actually brewed randomly enough using a thing called distilled hop oil.
Yep.
Not only do they cram hops into every corner of this beer but they actually go out into the hop fields and take the fresh hop flowers and distill the hops and get an oil out of it and also put that in the beer. But this one is still an IPA. Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
That is an extremely good beer. I'm a big fan.
Mm.
It's pretty hoppy.
Yeah.
Pretty
very hoppy.
Yeah.
You get that kind of hop hit straight away. You get a nice big hit of bitterness, a lot of floral.
I was going to say, but it's got floral that really balances out.
Yeah.
Like, it's not mouth puckering.
No.
You know, there's other stuff happening too.
Yeah. So this brewery, Sierra Nevada, is quite famous for their use of the Cascade hops. So Cascade hops is this hop, and you know how you get that kind of citrusy, almost pine-like flavor in that? That's all from this particular style of hops, and Sierra Nevada just love these hops, and that's why you get this every time you drink a Sierra Nevada beer. You kind of know that it's a Sierra Nevada beer because of that.
I think for me the interesting thing about this one is that still for a lot of people, if you tell them that you love American beer, they'll look at you like you're insane, because American beer has such a bad reputation because of the sort of weak, flat kind of lagers that they were that they were known for, and that are still drunk, you know, across the entire country really. But now there's this amazing craft beer scene there that is leading the world, really, isn't it?
Absolutely leading the world. But I think that's kind of it. You know, there's like even in Australia, the craft beer scene's incredible because we've had this huge long history of terrible beer.
Yeah.
But we've got this kind of culture like drinking easy to drink, low flavor beer just to smash it down on a Sunday afternoon with your mates watching the footy. But that's changing drastically. Mm. And the craft beer scene is just turning it on its head. And nowadays, yeah. I think it's really good for the general beer drinking culture because people are drinking for, you know, quality, not quantity, when it used to be all about quantity.
Yeah.
It's changing fast. And the United States is a perfect example of that.
Uda, have you been to the Pacific Northwest? And
I have not been drinking beer there, right. I have to say. It's, but I'm getting quite excited at the thought of going and doing that.
Because you go into these bars and they're all... One of the things that I find interesting there is they're really into the tap handles. Mm. Each brewery puts a lot of work into what its tap handle looks like.
Okay.
And so you go into a pub and basically you sort of scan along the taps to see which handles they've got, and that'll tell you which local breweries they're using. And it almost seems that the handles seem as much a part of the culture as the beers themselves, really.
Yeah, I've met guys that make a living out of making tap handles.
Right.
It's their only job.
Oh, what a great niche job.
Yeah, so niche.
But there's such passion for it over there, for beer in general. I went to a brewery in Seattle, and what they were doing was they were having a competition where everyone would bring in their homebrew on one weekend, and the head brewer would sit there and he would taste all the homebrews, and whichever one he liked the most, they would then sort of produce a mass batch of that.
Oh, wow.
And sell it on and have that guy's name on it, just to, you know, get a bit of community engagement.
Yeah.
And also, you know, as a way of building their own profile. And people were super into it. They were really keen.
There are breweries that do that here as well.
Right.
I mean, the things of the craft beer world is, I mean, when I got into it, I was sort of thinking, oh, you know, it's cool. It's niche. It's growing. It's a great industry to be involved in. I love beer. But it's just beer, you know. You don't think much more of it. But now I've been involved in it for quite a few years now. I just realize that it's just such an incredible scene. And I don't know many other scenes where people are just so willing to help competitors out. They don't see competitors, you know. It's kind of like they're always willing to help the next person out. If they've got a certain ingredient that everyone loves, they'll always say what it is. There's no secrecy or hiding. And it's just a really nice, big, open scene.
Yep.
And I think that's worldwide as well.
Yeah.
And especially in the States.
Uta, you were saying that in Japan there's a craft beer scene as well.
Ah, oh, it is. Now, I haven't plunged into it yet because I did the whiskies first, then I did the sake. So right. The beer's going to have to be next trip. But there's this one brewery, you may even know which one it is. They're making this. It's the nerd thing, okay? And I love anyone who's nerdy about
Japanese get super nerdy about pretty much anything.
Ah, oh, absolutely. So beer, no exception. So they're making a beer that is made using red rice and the lees from sake fermentation.
Right, okay.
Now, I've got no idea what that's going to taste like, but I really want to know.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, mass-produced Japanese beer is excellent as well.
Well, so of course, they're all about the quality.
Yeah, yeah. So I assume the craft beer would be amazing.
It's going to be really, really good. And it's just that idea of trying to put the local spin on something. They're going, okay, so beer's pretty good, but let's make something really typically Japanese and showcase our local ingredients.
Yeah, I love that. Really cool. And there's a similar thing happening in Korea, or South Korea at the moment as well, because mass-produced South Korean beer is pretty bad. It's pretty watery, pretty tasteless. Apparently, it's made to match Korean food, which is very strongly flavored.
I was about to say, which has lots of flavor.
Yeah, so you want something sort of fairly dull that's not going to compete.
Okay.
I mean, one of the most popular drinks in South Korea is a mix of beer and soju. You pour the soju into the beer, and you know that's pretty much criminal for any decent beer to pour something else into it. But that's how they drink it over there. But there is also now a craft beer scene, which is being led by a lot of Americans who are coming over. American servicemen who end up staying there and they start their own craft brewery. But there seems to be a real thirst for it.
Oh, everywhere. Everywhere I go is starting. I mean, I was just in the Pacific, and just the most random little islands in the middle of the Pacific, you'll find a little craft brewery that started up.
There's one on Easter Island.
Is there? Oh, it doesn't surprise me.
It's not the world's best beer.
No.
But, you know, they're doing it.
Yeah, Port Vila. I found a brewery in Port Vila recently in Vanuatu.
Really?
The craft beer scene in Brazil is going gangbusters. Brazil's going great. And then South Africa as well. It's got a big craft beer scene.
Right.
Like you were saying, Japan is just really getting up there. Sweden's massive with craft beer now. And surprisingly enough, Amsterdam, around Amsterdam.
Oh, yeah, okay.
The Netherlands was just amazing for craft beer.
Yeah.
I did not expect that at all.
I mean, I guess that's kind of back to the future there, because they always used to have lots of tiny breweries, which I guess were taken over eventually by the Amstels and the Heinekens.
Yeah.
But now they're going back to that old style.
Now they're moving back. Yep.
Yeah. Is there anywhere you guys have been that has terrible beer that you just... You couldn't find a decent drink?
Well, Marshall Islands doesn't really have too many.
Right.
It's kind of like Bud Light or Bud Light over there.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Where? There's lots of places.
How about you, Uta?
It's not that it doesn't have good beer, but I've went down the wrong beer alley in India once, back when I was young and foolish and camping. And so we went on this trip, and the first night everyone wanted to party and I was pretty knackered. So everyone else drank beer all night long and partied. The thing was, they drank our entire 4-night supply of beer. So someone had to go while we were like making up. We were hiking across the Thar Desert, and someone had to go and find some beer from somewhere. And they brought back whatever this local beer was. And it was, so the next night I was like, okay, ready to party. Who's going to party? And two people put up their hands. And we coaxed some people to have a drink. And this beer, A, it didn't taste good, but B, it put everyone to sleep within half an hour because was like double the strength of whatever right. they'd been drinking the night before. And it was like, okay, we had to explain to our staff, this beer bad, this beer good, buy this beer. What about you?
There's only one country that I've been to that I haven't really not liked the beer, and it's Bolivia. I don't know what's going on there. There's so many things I love about Bolivia, but there I tried one beer and thought, that's just really horrible and almost undrinkable. I'll try a different beer the next night. And I tried a different one, and then I tried a different one, and they were all
and
really
you never
bad.
Got anywhere.
I'm not sure if it's something to do with the altitude, whether that changes the way you taste things. I know it does do that. Or if it's the way the beer is brewed at that altitude.
Or if it's
just really terrible beer. Yeah, I'm not sure.
But... And you should have been drinking the wine, which is surprisingly
yeah,
good.
Yeah, I ended up switching up to rum or something. I don't know, something really culturally inappropriate that tasted good.
Yeah, I was in Peru in a little town. I think it was Huanchaco, but in Trujillo.
Mm-hmm.
And we went down to the beach, and there's all like they've got this long history of taking these. They kind of look like reed surfboards,
right? Yeah,
the locals they've
for been fishing
for
right?
fishing,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But the way they kind of ride them in on waves, it's they believe that could be the first people that ever surfed,
right?
So we went down to this beach to do this little story, this little film, and me and a friend of mine took a couple of the reed surfboards out and started surfing along this beach,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think they'd ever seen two big. Blonde-haired, mop-headed gringos do it before because they were all so excited when we came into the beach, and they literally came out of the houses, they came out of the cars and started running down the beach, all of them carrying these cups of local beer.
Right.
So they went straight up to us and they're like, beer, drink. So we started sculling these cups of this like grainy, slightly sour local beer. And, oh, man, we drank quite heavily all afternoon with these guys, this stuff. I didn't know what it was. Anyway, so I found out later from our local friend that it's this local chicha that they make. So it's like a corn beer. But
right.
how they make it is they get the elderly ladies in the village to chew the corn kernels and then spit in a bucket and then mix it with a bit of water and then let it ferment for a few days. So there we are, merrily sculling down old lady saliva on a beach somewhere in Peru.
It was alcohol. It was sterile.
Yeah. That was the
worst. What did it taste like? Was
it? Oh, it just tasted grainy, a little yep. bit sour.
Like just similar to normal chicha.
False tooth in
yeah, a few false teeth. But it wasn't great.
So, guys, for people who don't drink beer, can you still go out to, you know, places like Oktoberfest or, you know, go out in the US and enjoy yourself? Are there still things to do if you're not a beer drinker?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, I did a beer tour through Bamberg and convinced my twin sister to come along, and she hates beer.
Right.
And she really enjoyed herself when she was there, but she became a beer drinker as she went along. So
right.
I don't know. But there's a lot of history behind it. There's a lot to learn. There's a lot of cultural experiences behind it, especially if you're in Belgium or if you're in Germany.
Yep.
With the craft beer thing, maybe not so much because it's very heavily beer related.
Yeah.
But if you're going to these traditional cultural festivals, say Oktoberfest or Bergkirchweih or any of these traditional festivals, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. What do you think, Uta?
Oh, absolutely. And yep. I think, as Tim's saying, it's the stories behind the beer that's really interesting, and particularly somewhere like Belgium where you do have sour cherry beer. You know, it's you might not like it, but it's worth tasting it. You know, it's beer is a very broad church, and you can find something in there.
It is a beautiful broad church. Well, guys, thanks so much for joining me. Tim, you bought 5 beers, and we only got through 4 of them. That's
all right.
That's
I'll be
really...
taking you on home. Don't worry.
Yeah.
I've got a roadie.
Fair play. Uta, Tim, thank you very much for joining me. Really appreciate having you guys along.
Thanks for having us, Ben.
To subscribe to Flight of Fancy, you can find us on iTunes or your favourite podcasting app. And we'll see you next time on Flight of Fancy.